May 13th, 1989, we're interviewing Dr. McCrae. We're up to about 1924 and at the beginning of his years at Princeton. I'm Stephen Haig, and my wife Gloria Haig is with us.
I'm Jim Pakula, the librarian at Biblical, and we're in room 27, and it's 8:50 a.m. Dr. McCrae, as Steve just mentioned, we covered up to the fall, the late summer, and going into the fall of 1924 last time when you entered Princeton Seminary. So we would like to invite you at this point to begin elaborating on perhaps your travel from the West Coast to New Jersey, experiences upon arriving at the seminary, experiences perhaps along the way before you did arrive as you made those final plans, and then, of course, that first year at the seminary.
Well, perhaps I'll begin with just a word on how I came to go to Princeton. It was because of men I knew at Occidental who were going there, and two of these had graduated when I did, 2 years before I went. So they had already had 2 years there, and they were telling me how Robert Dick Wilson had such fine answers to the attacks on the Old Testament. And they encouraged me to go, one of them even making an arrangement that I should be his roommate. They had a system there where they drew numbers to select rooms. This fellow already had a double room, so he didn't have to win the number. He simply told them that I would be his roommate the next day, the next year, rather. Maybe 3 months before I went, I saw Dr. Machen's book on Christianity and liberalism, and I was thrilled to read it, as I saw how clearly he pointed out the difference between Christianity and liberalism, which he said is not simply another religion than Christianity, but belongs to another type of religion, another series of religions. Then about two or three days before I went, the Los Angeles newspaper had a big article on the front page which said that Henry Van Dyke had walked out of the First Presbyterian Church at Princeton and gone across the street to the Second Presbyterian Church, saying that the sermon which was given by Dr. Machen was a bilious travesty of the gospel. It was unusual that we had news about Princeton on the front page of the Los Angeles paper, and this was quite an introduction to me to the seminary that I was about to attend. Then, in addition, I had talked to a student at Occidental who had was just graduating, and he was going up to San Francisco Seminary. He said that Princeton, he saw their catalog, and he said they were not up to date, alive, and moving forward, and he criticized me very strongly. In fact, he said he wanted a big church in Southern California. And he said, when you come back sometime from Alaska where it's frozen and cold, I'll let you preach for 3 months in my church for me. I was amazed at the selfish attitude that he had taken. When he entered Occidental, he had been a very warm-hearted evangelical, very anxious to lead souls to the Lord. Now, on the way to Princeton, I visited a friend in Chicago, and he worked in Chicago and was very active in the YMCA, where he had a room. And he told me that he was to get the speakers for young people's meetings, and he was going to visit two of the men that evening and invite me to go with him. He was very particularly anxious that I meet one of them, who was a professor at McCormick Seminary, who he said was a dynamic sort of fellow that they all liked very much. And so I went with him. And after they made the arrangements that this professor should come and speak to his group, the man asked me what I was doing. And I told him I was on the way to Princeton Seminary. And immediately he became very excited. And this man, Dr., I believe his name was Robinson, and he was rather well known at that time. He immediately declared that I was very foolish to go there. I should come to McCormick. He said, Princeton is a cistern. McCormick is a fountain. He said, they're just giving you old, out-of-date stuff. And he said, we here are moving forward with religious thought. He asked me where I went to church, and I told him the Highland Park Church, Camel Coil pastor. Oh, he says, Camel Coil, he says, he's a premillennialist. I said, yes, I said, that's what the Bible teaches, isn't it? Oh, he says, the premillennialism is a terrible scourge. He said, I just asked him leading questions. And he said, Paul made a mistake when he wrote 1 Thessalonians, or made a worse mistake when he wrote 2 Thessalonians. But he said he tried to redeem it when he first wrote 1 and 2 Timothy. He said, I wish that the Moody Bible Institute and the Los Angeles Bible Institute and all the other Bible institutes could be dumped in the bottom of Lake Michigan. He became so heated about these matters. That was quite an introduction to a Princeton for me, to see how heated this man felt about Princeton Seminary. Well, I went on and got to Princeton. It was a pouring rain all day long the day I got there, which was a rather poor introduction. But my roommate had a nice room, a room which was so situated on the second floor of Hodge Hall that it got sunlight from morning till night, and we never had to turn on the radiator through all the cold winters, while the room right across the hall from us, where Everett Harrison lived, who later became a professor at Dallas Seminary and then at the Fuller Seminary, that room, they had to have the heat on 9 months of the year. It was so cold there. I soon met Dr. Wilson and Dr. Machen and was very happy to meet both of them, and also again to see Dr. Alice, who, as I mentioned on the last interview, was I had seen in Chicago, in Los Angeles the year before, when he and Dr. McCartney, the moderator of the General Assembly, and I had gone for a visit up in the San Jacinto Mountains, and had a very interesting time of several days up there.
I wanted to ask there, Dr. McGray, who was your roommate that first year again?
His name was Woodbridge Johnson.
And Everett Harrison was...
across the hall.
I see. And do you recall the exact circumstance under which you first met Dr. Machen?
No, I don't.
Or others? Okay.
I don't quite recall the first meeting with them. But Dr. Wilson had a talk that he gave after school started, a talk which was, they called Cui Bono, for what value? And practically all the students used to attend this first meeting of the entering students for the Hebrew class. And the purpose of it was to talk on what is the value of taking Hebrew. But it was not a very well-organized talk. I was a bit disappointed, but it was full of fire and enthusiasm. And the students, many of them would go every year to hear him give this talk. I didn't have anything more from Dr. Wilson for two or three months after that. But the opening address was given by Dr. Samuel Zwemer, the veteran missionary to the Mohammedans, who had many years in Mohammedan lands and is, I think, still to this day regarded as one of the greatest pioneers among missionaries to the Mohammedans. I liked the message very much. It was giving different alleged substitutes for Christianity and for conversion, such as he spoke of people saying how character was built up by environment. And he said that if a cat had kittens in the oven, they wouldn't be biscuits. And that environment alone is not sufficient to produce life. I thought that and other illustrations he gave were very good. But when I saw Dr. Machen shortly after, I mentioned how I liked it, and he didn't seem to have liked it quite so much. He said that Dr. Zwemer was working with unbelievers, and he was joining with modernists. And I was a little bit perplexed right at that time, because his message really was a very excellent message. However, it was interesting that Dr. Zwemer was a man who was so anxious to reach the unbelievers with the witness of the Lord that he just could not bear to have anything interfere with the progress of the gospel. And he thought that the differences of opinion on other matters should be more or less forgotten. And the result was that he did work with those who really had no sympathy with anything that he held, but he held very strongly to his own belief in the gospel. And well, very intelligently, too. The result of this was that the students at the seminary who really believed mostly had something of a prejudice against Dr. Zwemer, and that the students there who were liberals in their view, of which there was a very substantial number, they looked on him as an ally. In fact, when we had excited meetings in the of the student body, he would sit by the leading liberals and give them advice. I saw that Dr. Zwemer was to give a course in Mohammedan apologetics, and I signed up for it. But I was the only evangelical who did. So the class had quite a number of fellows who had gone to liberal colleges and considered what I believed as pretty old-fashioned junk. They made up most of the class. I was the only evangelical in the course. And Dr. Zwemer gave most interesting accounts of conversion of Muslims and dealt with various arguments, and these fellows would look at him wondering how so intelligent a man could present such nonsense. Well, I was thrilled with what he gave. It was very interesting to see this situation. Well, I should mention that there were this many students of this type in Princeton was due to the fact that while Princeton was then attracting a large number of evangelicals from many denominations because they knew they could get the defense of the faith better there than anywhere else, or at least anywhere else that I had heard of, were a good many of them who were sons of Presbyterian ministers who had been to Princeton 20 or 30 years before and remembered Princeton as it used to be. While their sons had gone to so-called Christian colleges and there had been completely deprived of any interest in real Christianity and were interested only in getting a good church where they would have a good income. And these fellows, with whom I did not have a great deal of contact, except for this taking this one course with them, they showed not only no interest in Christianity, but no interest in what we would consider good morality. They had even some pictures on their walls that we would consider degrading, and some of them were drinking some. But they were not over a fourth of the student body, while the bulk of the student body were very earnest Christians.
What other courses did you take that first term? Were they on a semester system?
They were on a semester system. No, yes, they were. They were supposedly on a semester system, but most of the courses ran through the year. And that was one thing that I think has been improved most places since. There were many courses which were 1 hour through the year, others which were 2 hours through the year. So we had comparatively few examinations in the middle of the year, and most of them came at the end of the year and covered the whole year.
Did you enroll for a large number of courses since they met just 1 hour then?
Yes.
Was there a wide range?
Quite a wide range of courses.
Could you describe some of those and some of the professors? Was there some tension in the faculty? Was there diversity? What appealed to you and what struck you about the range of courses you were starting to take there as a seminary?
Yes. Of course, the big emphasis was on language in the beginning of the year there. And I think they made a mistake that they excused me altogether from any course in Greek. Now, it was 2 years since I'd had any Greek. I'd had 2 years of Greek in college. And I'd done a little reviewing, not a great deal. So I never had any course simply in the Greek language. And I wish I had, because Dr. Machen was such a wonderful teacher. And in his Greek course, the students would tell how interesting it was, how he would walk up and down the room throwing pieces of chalk in the air, catching them, and he would put a book on his head and balance it there and do things like that in order to enliven the dreary beginning course. And he was not that way at all in the courses I took from him, which were more advanced. But it was one of the things students enjoyed was his beginning courses. But that's not why I'm sorry to have missed them. It is because I feel that a more thorough grounding in Greek than I got would have been good to have had all through my life. But I began Hebrew that year with Dr. Alice. And Dr. Alice was a very mechanistic sort of teacher. He would take a point and he would go through it and explain it very carefully. Then he would explain it again. He would do that about six times. By the time he'd done it three times, it was in my mind so clearly that I was bored to hear it anymore. He would do it about six times. And then someone would raise a hand and say, "Would you please explain such and such," which would be the same thing, and then he would give the whole thing over again. He was very, very methodical, step after step this way, and I thought rather boring. But I felt I got what he gave, I thought, quite easily. So when Dr. Alice invited me to be his guest at a football game at Thanksgiving, and I went, I thought to compliment him by saying that he made the Hebrew so clear that it only took me about 20 minutes study for each lesson. And he was shocked. "Why," he says, "does that mean you're not interested in getting to the Aleph division?" Well, the Aleph division there meant the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. It meant the top division. Then they had a base.
Right, I believe you described this on the previous tape.
Did I?
Yes, yes. And then you began studying much more.
Yes, yes. Oh, I've already told that. Yes.
Did they excuse you from Greek because of a placement test?
A placement test, yes.
I see. Were there any other placement tests you took?
No, that was the only placement.
And what other what other courses did you have besides Hebrew?
There was a course from Dr. Davis in Old Testament history. Dr. Davis was the author of the Davis Bible Dictionary, which was a very good work. He was getting along in years then. His teaching was quite clear, on the whole, I thought, rather simple. You know, his Old Testament history course was a worthwhile course. See, I had that and the one from Machen, and I had the beginning Hebrew. I don't know what I can think of. What else I had that
did year. You have any of the professors who were not as evangelical?
Yes, there was the professor of church history was Dr. Letcher. This is the father of the man who later was professor of church history there. One of the second year students said to me, "Oh," he says, "you will enjoy," they called him Chesty Letcher. And he says, "you'll enjoy Chesty's prayers," he says. Well, Chesty spoke in a very sort of a dignified bass voice. And I went to his first, his church history was 1 hour a week. The very first day, I heard him say that the heterodoxy of today is the orthodoxy of tomorrow. But that does not mean that every heterodoxy is going to be, such as the Fausticium, is going to become orthodox. And I was shocked at that statement because it suggested that our Christianity was evolving and what is true today would be false tomorrow. I didn't like it. And his sympathies were definitely not with Machen and Wilson. I don't think his church history teaching was outstanding. Yeah, I thought he could take the most interesting subjects and make it dull. He was somewhat in demand to give lectures on Calvin. And he could go to a church and speak on Calvin and make him live. And people enjoyed it. But in class, he made it dead and uninteresting. And when I would, I knew a little bit about church history already. When I would walk with one of the students after one of his classes where he talked about some ancient worthy, and it had been quite dull, and I would tell him some interesting thing about the man I had heard once, my fellow student would say, "I wish you would teach church history." And that perhaps had something to do with my eventually teaching, even though it never was my center of interest.
Dr. McCray,
yes.
How many professors would you say were non-evangelical or moving towards liberal?
There was nobody there who would admit to being non-evangelical. But there were three or four who, maybe five, who strongly sympathized with the strong stand for the gospel that Dr. Machen took. And then there were three or four who felt that they never said anything to make you think that they didn't thoroughly approve of the viewpoint and stand of the seminary, but they strongly felt that the seminary should be more in line with other seminaries and in better terms with them, and opposed what seemed to some of us to be a strong stand against modernism.
So about
half and they, no, no, I would say two-thirds of them were with Dr. Machen, definitely.
Oh, okay.
All would claim to be as far as their views are concerned. And but the students used to remark later when there were excited meetings of the Presbytery of New Brunswick on certain ones who would go there and stand with Dr. Machen and certain ones who would go there and oppose him. And then they'd say, "And Dr. Letcher will go and play golf that day." And he took a sort of an uninterested attitude toward the whole thing. But some of us felt that the gospel was really being attacked all over and threatened, and rejoiced in the strong stand that Dr. Machen and Dr. Wilson were taking. Now, my roommate, who was president of the student body, and two others went to a meeting which was held, at which it was to be a meeting of representatives of all the seminaries with the idea of forming an interseminary organization. And at that organization, one of the other students said, "Now for working out a basis of union of our interseminary organization," he said, "let us think of what basis could the churches all be united into one big church." And so they proposed, the Fellows from Princeton proposed various statements that would strongly stand for the gospel. And most of the students from other seminaries didn't like them and took quite a different attitude. And they said that when finally one of them said, "Oh," he says, we can't agree on a detailed statement like any of these." He says, "Let's just stand on John 3:16. And one, a student from Union or Harvard, I forget where, said, "Oh, we can't do that." He said, "We don't believe that stuff about the only begotten Son." Another one said, "Oh," he said, "but if you exegete that verse properly, you can get rid of that." And that impressed the three fellows from Princeton very much, that they could exegete to get rid of any of the fundamentals of the gospel. When they came home, they were very excited about that. And the suggestion was made that they, Princeton, take the lead in forming an interseminary alliance with institutions that believed as we did. There were two there, which at that time they had real sympathy with, two which subsequently have moved very far away from that. But aside from, they felt the sympathy with these two and none with the rest, and so they suggested getting other seminaries that stood for the essentials of the gospel unite with them. And this precipitated great excitement and division within the student body, and even got big headlines in the Philadelphia papers and so on.
What were those other two schools? Seminaries. Do you recall?
Yes, they were the Moravian School and the Mount Airy. And from what I've heard, both of them moved a long distance from the stand that they were taking then.
So this was a wide range of seminaries across the country. It wasn't just Presbyterian seminaries.
Oh, it wasn't Presbyterian. It was seminaries of any denomination, but it was seminaries in that section. I think it was the under the general auspices of the YMCA that they were trying to get this, and Princeton withdrew from that organization, or else didn't join it, I don't know what it was, and proceeded to take steps toward forming an organization of the seminary students of similar views. And student body council, the student council, I forget what they called the organization, they sent out a letter to seminaries that they thought were of similar view, asking if they would join with them in forming an organization that, of seminary students from places that stood for the essentials of the gospel. And the student body had the letterhead. And on that letterhead was the name of the faculty advisor to the student council, which was Dr. Charles Erdman. And people began asking Dr. Erdman, "Do you agree with what it says in this letter?" And Dr. Erdman became very incensed. The students had sent this out. He did not like what they were trying to do. He always claimed to be very orthodox in all his views, but he was wanted to be very sweet to everybody, and everybody to stand together. Someone said of him, I think I heard him give one sermon, which he told of someone who was converted by a sunrise or sunset. I mean, everything was sweetness and light. There was never anything that was unpleasant. That is, unless you criticize him. Because, as a matter of fact, when people asked Dr. Erdman, they said, do you agree with what this letter says? Oh, he says, I don't have anything to do with that letter. Well, he said, your name is on it. So he made a fuss and objected to it. And the faculty said, the faculty agreed with what the students were trying to do. That is, three-fourths of them at least did. And they said, well, if Dr. Erdman disagrees with this, well, the majority of the faculty approve of it, and the majority of the students, shouldn't we appoint someone else to be the faculty representative on the student council? And so they, instead of Dr. Erdman, they appointed Dr. Machen. And the Philadelphia papers had headlines, Dr. Erdman ousted. And people got the idea Dr. Erdman had been fired from Princeton Seminary, when it was only a matter of the faculty putting somebody else as advisor to the students. But they were, someone said they, it seemed as if in the newspapers, anything that happened at Princeton at that time was put up as big news.
Well, Dr. McCray, did the conservative students try and form any kind of organization?
Yes.
To resist?
The conservative students were in the large majority in the student body. And representing the student body, they tried to form an organization with student bodies of other seminaries. And eventually, I guess there were 15 or 20 seminaries in this organization, which had the national meetings and occasional lesser meetings.
And the initial attempt for that was this letter that went out on with Dr. Erdman's name on the letterhead. With all this publicity and so on, there must have been a sense of among everybody at Princeton of a kind of what was going on, wasn't there? In other words, something like a faculty member being replaced as a student council faculty person would hardly generate headlines in a newspaper today, you know, as you think about Princeton or anywhere. Was there a sense in which Princeton was a focal point in a larger context? How much awareness?
I think there was.
Of this?
I think there was. At this time, there was a series of articles in a widely read magazine called The World's Work, a series of articles on what was it? It was on the dispute within the churches, and they talked about the liberalism and conservatism and how liberalism had swept most of the large denominations, but the conservatives were opposing it, and they would refer to Moody Bible Institute as a leading institution among conservatives, and they'd always put in parentheses entrance requirement high school or equivalent. But they had to recognize Princeton Seminary as standing with them, so they would refer to it as the only institution of really higher learning, which they considered to be taking that approach.
Well, Dr. McCurry, maybe we should take a break at this point.
Oh, sure, maybe the students weren't aware.
I see Lefferts' book, but it only gives quite a distorted view of the whole thing.
What's the name of that book?
The Broadening Church.
The Broadening Church. And see, I would say that Dr. Erdman was not interested in broadening the church. That Dr. Erdman believed, he followed his father, who was one of the advisors to the writing of the Schofield Bible. He claimed to be a premillennialist and go right down the line on Christian doctrine. But I never had the impression it went very deep. He liked people to like him. To jump forward quite a ways, and then my roommate, Woodbridge Johnson, graduated that year, and then he went up to Canada and preached for a year, and he came back for a visit, and he was in Princeton. After the end of my second year, and I stayed around there that summer for a little while, and Woodbridge said to me, Woodbridge Johnson, he said, let's go to the First Presbyterian Church tonight. He said, Charlie Erdman's preaching. Well, I didn't have a desire to hear him preach, but he did. And I had seen Erdman around in the halls and on the street occasionally, but he was always very polite to everybody. He wanted everybody to like him. And we went to service. And when the service was over, Woodbridge said, let's go up and speak to Dr. Well, I was willing. So we went up, and Dr. was talking with somebody. And as he talked to them, he sort of realized there was somebody else waiting there to see him. But he went on talking with them for a little. Then, and Woodbridge, he hadn't seen for over a year. He'd been student body president, been active in all these things. Well, Erdman, when this other person left, he turned around and he saw me. Why, Mr. McCray, how are you? And he shook my hand, and you'd have thought he hadn't seen me for 2 years, and I'd seen him around the halls day after day before that. And then he saw Woodbridge Johnson, who had been away for a year, right here before. He says, oh, Mr. Johnson, how are you? And there was no cordiality toward him at all. And the reason to gush over me, when he'd just been seeing me and not be unfriendly, but not, it wasn't any particular thing to see me, it gave me an impression of professionalism, of just being real nice to everybody, you see. And it's not being no depth to it. And I had the feeling about it, that feeling about his books, too. He wrote little books on all the books of the New Testament, separate little books dealing with them. And he takes the simple truths about these books as they are known and writes them up in a nice little way. But, I mean, there's no depth to it at all, nothing. But it seemed to me that the big thing he wanted was that everybody would support him.
Yeah, in Letcher's book, apparently, he says that Erdman went to those liberals who wanted to leave. So the liberals were fed up, they wanted to leave and get out of Princeton, tired of the situation. And he claims that Erdman went and tried to persuade them, pleaded with them to stay. And they stayed.
This was the denomination, not the seminary. This was at the time of the General Assembly, I believe.
But they were the professors in the seminary.
No, oh no.
Oh no, it had nothing to do with
No, the nothing to do with the seminary.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
This was in the church courts.
Yeah.
There was the struggle. I know Machen opposed his Erdman being elected moderator.
Oh, yes, because Erdman wasn't making any stand for the faith. He was trying to have everybody like him. That seemed to be his primary. And, you know, it was very sad. There was Charlie Erdman, who had such grace. He would preach about being converted by his sons. Oh, it was beautiful. And he had such grace and charm. Most everybody liked him. And his brother, Walter Erdman, was a very earnest Christian. Very, very fine. But he didn't have that grace to try and see. And people would just go crazy about Charlie Erdman. Well, they wouldn't pay so much attention to Walter, who was a wonderful Christian and a very fine man in every way, an effective missionary to Korea, I believe, for some time. Maybe you've seen the book Borden of Yale?
Yeah.
Well, Walter Erdman went with Borden on a trip around the world, I believe. So on. But that was very sad to me. But it was partly Erdman's charm that first introduced me to Princeton Seminary. And after seeing his charm, it was a little let down to see Robert E. Wilson and the others who did not have that particular charm. But I very soon saw that they had what I liked, and he didn't. So.
Did you have Dr. Voss at all that
yes,
first year?
Dr. Voss, we had all 3 years. He was a Dutchman, and he had a little bit of an accent. He was a very good scholar, had studied under some great Aramaic authorities, so on, written books in Dutch and in English, and had the funny habit that he would give a lecture, and he would call on someone, and the person would stand up, and he would ask them a question which they could answer in two or three words, and then he would go ahead and lecture them. And he might talk 5 minutes with the person standing there. And then when he finished, he would leave off the last two syllables of the last word, like he would say. And that is the solution to the whole problem. And he'd stop and the student would say, Lem. He would always do that. And they said that one fellow he had up that way, and he came to the end, and Dr. Voss said, the Prince of Purr, and the fellow says, sure. And he said, and Dr. Voss says, dish him.
Did he do that on purpose? What was?
I don't know how he ever got into that habit. It was a queer habit.
I almost wonder if
he was an awfully nice fellow.
Seeing whether the person was still listening to him, or
I don't know.
Did you get home for Christmas that first year?
Those were the days before planes.
Were you hosted by some faculty member for the holiday, or what did you do?
My first year at Princeton Seminary, I went up to Hartford, Connecticut, to the home of a cousin of my mother, and spent the time there. My mother had been brought up in northern Vermont, but she had lived as a young woman in Hartford, Connecticut, and she had cousins there who were very nice people, and I spent that Christmas period with them.
Now, where did you attend church? Did you go to one church every Sunday morning, and did many of the other students go?
That's an interesting thing. Now, I usually went to the seminary chapel. Dr. Voss gave, I remember one very excellent sermon. I went up and said, oh, Dr. Voss, I wish you'd have it published. He said, it's been published in my book, Grace and Glory, which was a book of his sermons. His sermons were full with meat, but occasionally they would have us white-known speakers from around to speak there. The pastor of the Second Presbyterian Church of Pittsburgh, whose name I don't think of right now, but was a very strong evangelical, he was, in my third year, he was announced to speak in the seminary chapel, and these liberal-minded students, when this announcement was made, they said, you'll have to sit up front if you're going to hear it, which my friends thought, they said, in order to discourage people from going to hear this outstanding evangelical. And when he got there, we found he had a big booming voice, so that it was purely a maneuver to keep people away.
Was there always that sort of tension, that obvious sort of rub between the types of students?
The League of Evangelical Students, you see, brought it to the fore. Now, like Dr. Zwemer's lectures, which I thought were so good, none of the other evangelical students took the course. And all the liberal students took it. And they all couldn't understand how such an intelligent man who helped them could believe such nonsense as the virgin birth and the resurrection and so forth. Huh. It was really peculiar.
Well, did the liberal students form an organization like
the
League?
They didn't form any organization. They tried to get their fellows elected officers. And they tried to, like little ways like this, trying to keep people going, but the majority of the students were very definitely evangelical.
How did the dining clubs work?
Yes, they had four dining clubs, each of which had a had a house which they owned, and one which was the more prominent was the Benham Club. And the Benham Club was the stylish club. They, when Ray Brains, my friend who had so much to do with my going to Orson, was going, he told the president of Occidental, who had been a teacher at Princeton, that he was going to Princeton. Oh, he says, let me give you an introduction to the Benham Club. He says, you can't get a decent church if you're not a member of the Benham Club. Well, Ray Brown kept very carefully away from anything to do with the Benham Club. And the majority of the really liberal-minded fellows were in the Benham Club. But they were not liberal-minded in the sense of having an opposition to the gospel. They just were indifferent to it. And there were men who looked with church as a good livelihood and a chance to be prominent, and so on, as far as I could judge them. But the Benham Club had a big appeal with their attractiveness that they had. The club that Ray belonged to, the other Occidental fellows belonged to, was the Friar Club. And the Friars Club, someone said once, the nucleus of the Friars Club was two groups, group from Occidental and group from University of Pennsylvania. And that was the nucleus, not over a fourth of the club. But the Friars Club contained the men who were really interested in having an influence in the church. And Machen was a Benham. He had been a member of the Benham Club, and the result was that when the liberals made a big attack on him in the General Assembly, they couldn't get any member of the Benham Club to stand up and publicly attack Machen, although they all greatly disliked him. But they there was a sort of like a fraternity attitude among them. Then I mentioned the Friars Club. Then there was the Calvin Club, which was quite a small group. Fellows who were, I think, mostly good students and interested in doctrine, but rather inconspicuous on the whole. And then the rest were the Seminary Club, which was a large group. And more or less, whoever wasn't in the other three. The seminary, the size of the clubs, of course, was dependent on the size of the houses. They were only eating clubs. And the way they got into the clubs was that in the fall, all the students, all the new students would be entertained at each of the four clubs. You would be given notice to eat at this place, so they all had a chance to see you. And then you would vote on what club you wanted to join. And the clubs would vote on who they wanted. And you would mark them 1, 2, 3, and 4, and the number under each that they had room in the club. And heads of the clubs would get together, and would give a rating, I think, of 1 1/4 to the ratings of the club, and 1 of the ratings of the individual. But that they wouldn't necessarily, the fact that you gave a 1 rating, wouldn't necessarily put you in a club, because they might be full, you see, at the time they got to you. Or if they gave you a 2, you see, but they were from Occidental, and they knew that Occidental would give them first place. And so they figured if they gave the Benham Club first place, and we gave it, and we gave it first place, that the club had a greater percentage, slightly more than the individuals will. So that would mean that they'd be friars, even if they'd given us second place, you see. So they said, we'll give Benham first place and friars third. And they said, we figure they'll give us first, and then if we don't get the Benham Club, we'll be in the friars. But the Benham Club quota was full before they got to that. And the result was they were in the seminary. much to their discussion.
Huh. Was the seminary club...
Oh, thank you, sir. Yes.
Yeah, take a good drink of water there. Help your throat. Are you ready to break, or would you like...
I get interested in that.
What is it? Was there... was the seminary club kind of... those who maybe weren't as economically...
No, money had nothing to do with it.
It didn't.
No, the clubs were very inexpensive. They were very inexpensive, and anyway, the seminary gave so much financial help that nobody had any need of the single students.
Did the denomination pay the tuition like they do today?
They charged no tuition in those days. No seminary charged tuition. It was not till the 60s. That any seminary charged tuition. I was at a meeting with a group of presidents of seminaries in Chicago, and Dr. Walborg of Dallas mentioned that they had announced they were going to give a tuition charge of $100 the next year, and that they had heard that they wouldn't have any students if they charged $100 for tuition. So he said, he called all the students together, and he said, we are planning to introduce a charge of $100 tuition. With those of you who won't come, if that's the case, because the rumor was around they wouldn't have any students, would you please raise your hands? And he says, one fellow raised his hand. So they went ahead and introduced $100. And I imagine they charged more than $100 by this time.
$100 for more than $100 for one credit hour.
But in those days, no seminary charged tuition. They felt it was the place of the seminary, of the denomination, to train their students. And so at Princeton, if you were a student of Princeton and belonged, no matter what you belonged to, any denomination, you could apply for $100 a semester, and they would give it to you, but you signed a statement that if you were not in Christian work for 5 years after you got out, that graduated, that you would repay the money. And if you were a Presbyterian, you could sign the statement, and that if you were not in the Presbyterian denominational service for 5 years after you graduate, you would pay back. And so most of the students got both tuition on both. I mean, they got help on both grounds, and there was no tuition charge, and the room was free. All you had to pay was... and, of course, practically all students in those days came direct out of college. There were very few older folks.
And probably few married.
There were very few that were married, and of course they lived around in the town. They got apartments. But there were very few married, and at when we started Faith, our transfer students were married, but our new students, none of them were married until Norman Jerome got married second year, I think. You know Norman, I believe. And then the war came. And when the war was over, we had the new student just out of college, and we had another generation that had lost 4 years on account of the war who came. And they all had the GI Bill to pay their expenses, and they were all married. So that set the example. And since then, practically all seminary students are married. But going to seminary was a very inexpensive thing in those days, you see.
Do you think that situation encouraged things like the Benham Club, where men would just look at the ministry as an easier way to go, and they could do it as a profession, the seminaries paid for?
Oh, I doubt. Tuition was very low. Any college in those days, the tuition was a small factor. I think when I entered it seems to me that it was $200 a semester when I entered Occidental, and that when I graduated, it got up to $300. Tuition was very low, everything.
Good afternoon. It is Friday, May 19th, 1989, and Steve Haig, Jim Pakula, and Dr. McRae are meeting for this oral history interview in the conference room at Biblical Theological Seminary, Hatfield, Pennsylvania. It's approximately 2:20 p.m. Dr. McRae, last time we were discussing the year 1924 to 1925, your first year at Princeton Theological Seminary.
I would like to go back just a little before my first year. As I look back on it, I am surprised to think of how little the general Christian public, how little idea they had at that time of the growth of liberalism within the church and of its spread. The tendency of the earnest Christians was to think that everyone who occupied a position as Christian minister or Christian professor was one whom we could with confidence listen to and could follow. Now, we had much contact with the teachers of the Los Angeles Bible Institute at that time, and they were very fine Christian men. We had great confidence in them. One of them had recommended to me the year before I entered college, when I was working on an olive branch. He recommended a certain book to me for morning devotions. It was called The Manhood of the Master, written by Harry Emerson Fosdick. As I went through the book, he quoted passages from the New Testament and then applied them to matters of human characteristics. And it was a very well-written book. But as I went through, I more and more felt the lack of any statement or reference to him as being more than a man or having qualities that we could not expect to emulate. I mentioned this to the man who had recommended the book, and he said, oh, here he's dealing simply with the human side of Christ. He said he'll probably write another book dealing with his divine side. Well, it was a few years after that Fosdick began preaching at the First Presbyterian Church in New York. And as he preached, he gave one sermon there, Will the Fundamentalists Win?, in which he assailed the believers in supernatural Christianity very, very strong. Clarence McCartney, pastor of the Arch Street Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia, preached a sermon in which he assailed Fosdick for this. And at the General Assembly, the summer before I entered Princeton Seminary, they elected McCartney moderator on the matter of getting Fosdick out of the First Presbyterian Church. But it was impossible to persuade the presbytery to condemn him to the General Assembly. Instead, the attitude taken was, well, we will invite him to, if he's going to preach in a Presbyterian church, to apply for admittance to the presbytery. And then he will be examined on his doctrine. And so they simply extended to him an invitation to come and appear before the presbytery, at which Fosdick repudiated rather scornfully, and Rockefeller built him that great, beautiful Riverside church up there in New York, at which he preached for a long time after that. But I
mentioned Robert Speer.
Oh, yes, thank you. My mind slips a cog every now and then.
We might mention to any listening to the tape that unfortunately technical difficulties required us to begin again in this taping this afternoon, and Dr. McRae had made such an eloquent beginning we didn't want to lose
any of that material, and so we're going back and had to start afresh. So you'll certainly understand how Dr. McRae's recollecting and gathering his steam again. Thank you.
Yes. Yes, at that time, Robert E. Speer was a name that was almost revered by the Christian public, and he was thought of as a very great Christian leader. In later years, when it was widely shown how the Presbyterian Board of Missions was sending out unbelievers to the mission field, I several times heard very fine Christian leaders say, well, as long as Robert E. Speer is the leader of the Presbyterian Mission Board, I will have complete confidence in it. Now, that summer, before I came, went to seminary, Dr. Speer gave a talk in Los Angeles, and with that great, wonderful voice of his and that very, very fine manner, he told how someone had asked, what is the one word that summarizes Christianity? Now he said, Mohammedanism can be summarized in the word submission. And he gave some word for Buddhism and maybe for one or two other religions. And then he said, but for Christianity, the word is unity. And then he went on to talk about the wonder of unity, of brothers working together in harmony. And he ended with a beautiful illustration of a missionary who had come back from Africa and had a terrible disease that he had picked up there. And he was in the hospital in New York with this disease that affected his whole body. And as they gave him medicine there, he said he felt that his mind cleared, his head cleared up. And then it was his arms and the lower body that felt so bad. And then they cleared up. And then the upper legs did. And finally, it was only his feet that were suffering with this. And then it went away from the feet. And he said he had the most marvelous feeling of unity now. Well, afterwards, I mentioned to this fine Christian to whom I've referred to this before, I mentioned to him that it didn't seem to me that unity was really the typical word of Christianity. In fact, it seemed to me that this story about the missionary and the disease was more one for getting rid of the disease and driving it out than one for having unity with it. Well, he was rather shocked that I should criticize such a wonderful man as Robert E. Speer. But I saw him a week later. This
was the professor from Biola?
Professor from Biola.
Do you recall the name?
His name was John Hunter.
Gee.
Very fine man. And I saw Mr. Hunter about a week later, and he said to me, you know, he said, in view, he said, of what you said, why, this week I asked several people, how could you summarize Christianity in one word, if you had to? And he said not one of them mentioned unity as the word. And it seemed to me that was the very opposite of what we need, that we need a church in which true Christians are unified. But we need to get rid of that, of the disease that would wreck the body and would destroy it. Well, everybody had tremendous confidence, nearly in spirit, it seemed, at that time. I got to Princeton Seminary, and my roommate there was the president of the student body. And after a little time, there was held a great foreign missions convention in Washington, D.C. I've never heard of a convention quite like that since. It brought people from all over the United States, and they had missionaries from just about every mission board and from just about every country. And it was a most interesting combination of people there. I enjoyed the several days that we spent there very much. But my roommate and I were assigned a room at the home of one of the Presbyterian ministers of one of the large churches in Washington. And when we got to the home, we were told that Robert E. Speer and his wife were also entertained there, and So with another theological student in addition to ourselves. Well, the next morning we came down to breakfast, and the wife of the minister greeted us, and we greeted the other young theological student who was there. And she said, well, here, and also she introduced us to Dr. and Mrs. Spear. And then she said, now here are two men from Princeton Seminary, and here is one from Union Seminary. Which are you, Dr. Spear? She said. And Dr. Spear said with that great voice, well, historically, I am Princeton. But locally, she said, locally, your Union? Locally, I am New York City, she said. Well, I couldn't help thinking. Here was this man who was a graduate of Princeton Seminary, who was a member of the board of Princeton Seminary, who claimed to be one of the great leaders in standing for the biblical views that Princeton Seminary stood for. And why would he hesitate to say, I'm for Princeton Seminary? I was really quite shocked at the attitude that he showed at that meeting. But we had a pleasant time around the breakfast table, and it was nice to get acquainted with him a little bit there. Though I must say I valued my friendship with McCartney more, who took the out-and-out stand for Christianity. Now, that was a stirring year at Princeton Seminary. Most of the big seminaries of the United States had been taken over by the liberals. I remember during that year that I visited Yale Seminary. And in Yale Divinity School, I heard a man give a most interesting talk, one of their professors, in which he talked about the theology of John and the theology of Peter, and he would give a few little statements from each that you recognize as being definitely part of his view. And I thought he gave, in general, a rather fair picture of the difference, not in the views, I wouldn't say, but in the emphasis of two men. But as he gave it, you had the feeling as if he was holding up a very queer prehistoric animal in front of you and showing its peculiar features, and then holding up another one and sort of laughing at the peculiar features of this one, so different from the other one. A friend of mine wanted me to visit a friend of his who'd been in that divinity school only a short time. He said, one day, they take the Gospel of John out of the Bible. The next day they take out this book, and the next day that book, and he was very unhappy about it. I tried to persuade him to leave and come to Princeton, but I couldn't budge him. So I suppose he, like most theological students, in the end gave in to the views that were being taught. In fact, my observation is that the people who fight hardest against the views and are faced by the teachers who know far more about the subject than they can ever know, generally, by the end of their course, are completely on the side of those whom they had formerly opposed. Well, at Princeton, somebody had convinced the General Assembly, at which McCartney had made this big stand against Fosdick, somebody had persuaded the General Assembly that they needed to investigate dissension in Princeton Seminary. And so a committee of the General Assembly came about 2 weeks after I entered the seminary. And I attended one or two of the public meetings which they held, in which they would listen to graduates of the seminary. And it was an exciting day. None of us could study during that time at all. But I remember a man who I don't think most of them had heard of before, a graduate of the seminary named Stevenson, who maybe was pastor of a large church in Cincinnati. I'm not quite sure now. But he got up and said that he thought the trouble with the seminary was its president, that Dr. Stevenson, I think they had the same last name, though not related, that he was trying to change the seminary. Well, at the next meeting of the board of directors, they elected this Stevenson a member of the board of Princeton Seminary, which showed where the board of directors stood. But that brought our attention to the fact that Stevenson, the president, was definitely trying to change the seminary. Now, I had a course in missions from Dr. Stevenson, and in the course, he brought a Presbyterian minister who was president of a college in India to give a series of lectures to us. And this missionary educational leader, in the course of his lectures, referred to the fact that in their Christian college, in this place in India, they had professors who were Buddhists and who were Mohammedans and different religions. And one of the students asked him, why do you have men teaching in your Christian college who are not non-Christians? And the answer the man gave was, some of our non-Christians are our best Christians, which showed that what he was interested in was pleasant character, a nice, friendly attitude, a kindly spirit. That to him was Christianity, rather than the belief in great doctrines, which will produce that spirit and that attitude. I thought when I was in college one time, or even when I was in high school, I forget just when, I thought of the fact that in New England, in the early days, it seemed as if you had people who were ready to stand and fight for great Christian doctrine. But as you read of their stand and their fight and their emphasis on these doctrines, sometimes you feel as if their character's a little harsh. Well, then, the next generation, you find a beautiful Christian spirit with somewhat of a forgetfulness of the doctrine. And then in the next generation after that, you find Christianity gone and getting off into all kinds of wickedness. I remember, I think it was Nathaniel Hawthorne, who was a good example of the second step in that. And then his son, Julian Hawthorne, I believe it was at that time, was imprisoned for some scheme of defrauding that he had been involved in. And I thought you can often trace that, that humanly speaking, the second step appears more pleasant and gracious and attractive to us. But it's on the way between the first and the third. And that the source from which the fine Christian character comes begins with an understanding of the Christian doctrines and with their having a real place in our lives. Well, during that year at Princeton Seminary, there was great dissension in the student body because while we had people there from many different denominations who had come because of the great stand that Dr. Robert Dick Wilson and Dr. J. Gresham Machen were making for the great doctrines of Christianity, there were quite a sizable number who were the sons of Presbyterian ministers, who had gone to liberal Presbyterian colleges where their faith had been torn down and who now were interested, it seemed to me, only in a professional career that would give them a good living like their parents had had. And we used to have contacts with these people, but none of them became special friends of mine. I mentioned the different clubs there, and our club, the Friars Club, had the leaders of both sides. The men who wanted to change Princeton and the ones who wanted to stand for the great doctrines. And when we would have big debates in the student body, the leaders in the discussion were apt to be from our same EDIFA often. But toward the end of my first year at Princeton, the head of the Department of Sunday School Missions came to the seminary and said that they would be able to send one or more students from the seminary for summer work under the board of Sunday School Missions. And I spoke to him about it and told him I would be interested in anything that would take me out west for the summer nearer to where my parents were. And so he said, that they would send me as a missionary to work in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So I went out to Albuquerque that summer. I remember, by the way, he said they would they'd pay my way out, and I think he said they would give me, was it $15? $15 a week, I think they would give me. And at the end of, when I'd been there about 6 weeks, I got a check from them, which mentioned that this $60 was for that month, and they had switched me onto a monthly basis, on which there were half a week extra that I wasn't being paid for. And I simply wrote back and said, thank you for that money. It's $15 a week. I was promised it covers this number of weeks. And the next record from them was changed, so that whether somebody in the office had tried to put something over on me, or whether they had just overlooked it, I don't know. But when I mentioned specifically what it was, there was no problem. But in Albuquerque there, I stayed at the YMCA, and I had two preaching places. One was in the town, well, the name slips me at the moment, a little coal mining town. And the other was in South Albuquerque. There was a little chapel in South Albuquerque that had been built. It was a growing area of town, and things were not much built up in that general area. I preached there for a couple of weeks, and then I went up to this town up in 40 miles north of there. And the president of the coal mining company, they said, had been a professor of in the medical school in the University of Pennsylvania. Well, I rode up with him to this little mining town where they gave me a room in the what they call it, the room where their single employee, the building where their single employees had rooms and where we ate. And the Sunday school worker had gone up with me for the first day from the board, and he preached there that first Sunday, and then I was left there. And I went around and spoke to people and preached there. And I spent, I think, 2 or 3 weeks working mostly up there. And then I came down and spent the next 2 or 3 working largely in South Albuquerque. And it was very interesting work, and met some fine Christian people and many, well, people of different types I met. I remember one woman who, when I'd been 2 weeks up at the mining town, she had been working with the children in the mission down there. And she could have those children, she could have 50 children sitting perfectly still listening to her and controlling them. But her own children would run all around the place, and she just couldn't seem to control her own children, but did such a wonderful job with the other ones. I had many interesting little experiences in both places, and enjoyed the opportunity of service. I remember one young fellow who told me he would remember my sermons a long time, but he said he never would forget my prayers, which I was happy to hear him say. And I felt that I left some seed during that summer there. Oh, the principal reason I intended to say something about the summer was that during the summer they held the meeting of the Synod of New Mexico up at Santa Fe, north of Albuquerque. And quite a number of the leaders in the various boards of the church were present for the Synod meeting. They had one of the main speakers was a missionary, a returned missionary who seemed like a very fine character, but whose messages were quite, had many suggestions and points in that, to my mind, were quite a step away from Orthodox Christian teaching. I was talking to him one day, and he said, oh, he said, I like to roam on these by paths of recent thinking and ideas. He says, I love it, but when night comes, I like to come back to my mother's knee and remember the simple Christian messages that I got there. I felt sorry for the man who was being twisted between two opposite views and was wavering back and forth quite a bit. Well, at the Synod of New Mexico, they had Christian workers from all over the state, and they had some very fine ministers there at the meeting. And when Sunday came, they asked me to lead the young people's meeting. And I got verses from the scripture on Christian stand, a Christian stand and testimony. I remember one, I gave out one slip to be read, to read for reference, was the, if anyone come to you and bring not this doctrine, receive him not into your homes, and a few verses like that. And some of these people from the board, from the boards in New York, were at the meeting, and one got up and read the verse like that, which I had assigned. And then she said, now that is what James said, but she said, now actually we must be very friendly with people, whether we agree with them or not, and we must try to help them in a quiet, helpful way, and so on. And I felt she hadn't quite agreed with my emphasis. One night I was in the dormitory, and someone from one of the younger people connected with one of the boards was talking with me about my life, and I told him about Princeton and how much I liked Dr. Machen's teaching and others. And then he went over into another room, and the window was open there and in mine, and I heard him telling them about what I'd said about Dr. Machen. They said, oh, this man, Dr. Machen, Dr. McCartney, they're both old bachelors, and they have a crabbed attitude as a result of their being bachelors. And so I felt that there was a certain propaganda there from these board people against what Princeton stood for. They blame it all on Machen's not being married. But I never thought until this year, really, of the fact. I've wondered about it once or twice, but I never really thought about it, that the next year the board made no effort to ask me whether I would be interested in going again for the first time. Though at the end of that year, they had spoken with much commendation about what they heard about my work, and in fact, they had originally only promised to pay my way out, but they were enough pleased with it that they paid my way back. So I imagine the heads of the Sunday school missions department heard from these others about me later on and decided that they would just forget me as far as the future was concerned. One little humorous incident occurred there. There was a man, a good friend of mine named Clarence Bird, B-U-R-D, a very fine young man who was assistant pastor in the church at Albuquerque, and he was stated clerk of the Synod, and he was reading the report about a man who had left the ministry. I think he'd been dropped by the Synod, and they said that they had dropped him for contumacy. And then he went on speaking. But the word contumacy, he said in such a low, quiet way. I asked him later, I said, why did you sort of whisper on the word contumacy? I said, it just means sort of rebellion or insubordination. Oh, yes, he said, I knew the meaning of the word perfectly, but he said, I wasn't sure how to pronounce it. But it was a pleasant time there. I remember the minister of the church in the forget the name of the town now, a nice fellow. He was anxious to get to the east. And they said, oh, once you got out there, it was very hard to get a church in the east again. And they were, some of them were so anxious to get back here. They said that, one man told me, he says, you take just a little bit of a church in New Jersey, and if the place is vacant, you'll have 150 letters written asking from different people asking to be considered as a pastor. And
why was that?
I don't know. They all seem to think it's much better to be in the
east. Is it harder going out there with a large...
I know New Mexico is Catholic, and of course a lot of Native Americans.
Later on, I met a man from Albuquerque, a fine young man from a fine Christian family that I met in Albuquerque. He was connected with the Department of Roads, the government, and the result was that he and his wife would go to the trailer, and they would work in connection with the oversight of the road building and so on, in one place after another, so they might be in 30 or 40 different places over the weekend in the course of a year. And he said in every place they went, they would try to find a church where they would hear the real gospel. And it was just rare that they would find it. He said. It gave me an idea of how things were moving in the church at that time. I met a young, the year before I went to prison, I had gone to a YMCA conference for students at Christmas time, held at a Asilomar in California. And there I roomed with a young fellow who was a student at another seminary. And he told me, he had reached a point where there was really nothing that he believed in. He was a thoroughgoing modernist. And it's all psychology. Why are you going into it? Well, he says, when I was a young fellow, I heard the minister say, if the Lord wants you for his ministry, don't you dare turn your back on it. And he said, it made such an impression, I can't get away from it. But he said, it's just psychology. He didn't believe in any Christian doctrine. But he said, he says, my mother's a strong fundamentalist. But he says, I notice she's getting a lot softer in her attitude lately. Well, I thought with her only son having turned this way, it was quite natural that her heart would become softened and she would begin to wonder if she was too rigid in her attitude. But that was his attitude, and they put him and me together in this place. They had a minister there from Berkeley, First Congregational Church of Berkeley, who gave a... talk on the importance of the Christian ministry. He told how wonderful it was and how he preaches in the University of California's professors attend his church. And he says, my ideas are given in classes, places that I never even hear of. And he told how wonderful it was to go into the ministry, what an influence you could have. And he had a dynamic sort of a personality. People were tremendously, in fact, his name was Mr. McCall, I remember.
This was in New Mexico?
No, this was in Asilomar, the conference in California. And he had remarked on the value of the going into the ministry. So I went to see him, and I said, Mr. McCall, I was interested in what you said about the value of going into the ministry. Oh, yes, he said. Why would you tell me the value? Well, he said, there are two men whom I influence in my life that if I'd done nothing else, my life would be worthwhile. He says, one of them went out and became a great evangelist and led many people to faith in Christianity. He says, the other one went into social work. And he went into the, is either New Zealand or Australia, where she had come from. And he said he just had a tremendous influence there. And I said, Dr. McCall, would you mind telling me what you were preaching when these men's lives were changed this way? Oh, he said, the first one of them, He said, I was preaching the old-fashioned gospel. He said, I was about 18 or 19 years of age when I was in an evangelistic meeting and I went forward. He says, my life was just turned around. He says, it was completely changed. And he says, for the first next few years, he says, I preached the old-fashioned gospel and believed every word of it. And this fellow was came forward in one of his message meetings there. The other one, who went into social service, he says, mine was full of doubts about the Bible, about its authenticity, and about the truth of these old doctrines, which he'd now largely given up to. And I thought it was interesting that the influence that sent the man into the ministry came when he was really preaching. He said he was still preaching the same gospel, but he's full of doubt. And he sent the man into social service. And now he was dying. He said, many of these ministers come to me, he said, in California, and they say, how I admire the way you preach. He said, when I got the modern insights and gave up these old doctrines, I've lost my zeal. My sermons don't seem to influence people anymore like yours do. Well, then he started to tell me how can you believe the Bible as it stands. Look, Job had these children and this, and then he had the catastrophe, and then he had just as many again. He showed you know how it's coincidences. You know. So I gave him one or two coincidences that I'd come across in life. My life is full, you know. But when they find an instance in the Bible of it, why, that's proof. Can't believe that. But if you look at your life, you'll be bound to see all kinds of coincidences. They just do occur. Well, that first year at Princeton was a year of growth, of development, of interesting experiences, but a sad year as I saw the development in the seminary and the feelings becoming more crystallized. President Stevenson working to get the seminary changed, you could just feel it. You could see it. And the faculty members could see it. And then, of course, when the League of Evangelical Students was formed, then Dr. Erdman didn't want people to think that he approved of these things that were in the letter sent out, but he didn't want any of us to think that he differed from any of the Christian sentiments that we expressed in the letter. They said, what do you differ with in this letter? What is it? Well, he couldn't point to anything he didn't like, but he just didn't want his name connected with it. The sharp conflict between him and Dr. Erdman didn't come till later. That summer I went, after my first year there, I went to the General Assembly. And at the General Assembly, I think it was in Baltimore, if I remember correctly,